All right, dear friends, you're in for a treat. Our first hour together. It's probably weird for me to say that because, like, does that mean normally it's a bummer and this is going to be a good one? I don't know. But it will be, and I'll tell you what I have in store for you in just a moment. But before I get to that, I just want to bring you an update because in just a couple of days, we are launching our second annual reality in the Seattle area in Bellevue. And we sold out 3 weeks ago in Orange County, and we are shy 52 tickets of selling out in Seattle. So if you are interested in going, you can still get in. But those tickets aren't going to last long, all right? So 52 left. That means we've got 1,148 people signed up. We're maxed out at 1,200. That's the size of the venue. That isn't government restrictions this time. It's just that's it. So we got the extra spaces, the broom closets, and all that used up, right? And that's how many we can get in to our venue there. Thrilled to have that location in Bellevue. If you want information about the location, all the skinny there, just go to realityapologetics.com, all right? And you can find the information. That's going to be Friday, the 15th of October, and all day Saturday. So hope to see you there. Coming up, Minneapolis, November 12th and 13th. We're not sold out there yet. We got four more weeks, right? But that's a big church. That'll hold 4,000, and we are half full. We are just 20 shy of 2,000 people, more than 4 weeks out of Minneapolis and our reality event there. You can find the information, same place, realityapologetics.com, and I hope you sign up. I predict we are going to beat our best number, which is, I think, 2,700 in Orange County in 2019 before the COVID thing hit. But we're going to blast right through that. We got 2,000 already, for all intents and purposes, in Minneapolis, 4 weeks to go. And we hope that you're a part of it because it's going to be fabulous. And one of the stars, can I say it like that? I don't usually say that. That's creepy. Okay. One of the guys, one of the people. Well, I'm going to put it this way. I'm joined today by one of my absolutely favorite people in the world. Best-selling author of Cold Case Christianity, God's Crime Scene, Forensic Faith, the one, the only, J. Warner Wallace. Jim, hi.
I'll tell you what. When you say that, Greg, it means something to me because over these last, 15 years now, there's been a sweet kind of fellowship relationship that we've kind of grown, and I so value it. It's not often you get to go on someone's show where you would say that you are more than just friends, you're more than just kind of interviewer, interviewee. I feel like we are brothers, and the relationship is so important. You know, it's important to me, and you know the role you played for me. So I'm just grateful to call you a friend.
I agree, Jim. I mean, we got a history together, and actually the history goes back even before that I knew you personally. And I just wonder sometimes, I know you've sat behind this microphone so many times and filling in for me, which I'm deeply grateful for. And I know that the boards light up when you get behind the mic. I said, man, this guy's got a lot of followers here, and which is great. And I wonder if it's a little surreal for you. Since you listened to this program long ago when you were still an atheist, you know, kind of getting your footing in the Christian worldview, to be sitting behind that same microphone, essentially, that served you in some way so far back.
Yeah, you know, I think it's tempting. Isn't it tempting, Greg, sometimes to forget what it was like? I mean, for both of us, I mean, for you too, think about it. That God would do this is, I think the danger is in taking it for granted. Right. The danger isn't in saying, well, you never would have thought it would have happened. And then, the surreal thing happens. And then after a while, it becomes normal. I hope it never becomes normal.
I agree with you. You know, 3 weeks ago, we did Orange County, right? Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. The first time I walked into that church, I was 2 weeks old in Christ. It was the first church I walked into, and it was for a Calvary Chapel concert back there in the fall of 1973. And it was filled with young people. And they were, you know, praising the Lord and whatever. And so here I am 48 years later in the same building.
I know.
Except for it's filled with our young people who paid to be there and a whole lot more than were there that evening. And I honestly, Jim, sitting there in the audience, I got choked up. It was so sweet to my heart.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I mean, this is the thing that I think all of us who are in Christ have to be careful. You kind of see that pattern sometimes. And even I struggle with this too. Like we get to a place where I don't want to take this for granted. The same way I don't want to take my marriage for granted. I don't want to take the opportunities we've been given to write about Jesus for granted. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take reality conferences mm-hmm. for granted, because that is a remarkable work of God that's happening right before our eyes that I don't mm-hmm. think we could have ever predicted. Grant, we have to give a hat tip, you know, to Danielle and the work that she's done for you. Right. And the fact that all of the speakers come from Stand to Reason, when you invite a bunch of different guests. But my point is that the strength of the organization is driving this. There's no doubt about that. But I think we could be very careful. Look, you're right. We had 2,700 2 years ago, and we thought, we'll never do better than that. I mean, we've maxed this thing out. I mean, how much bigger can we get? Where are we going to go? And then we do Minneapolis the next year, and it's like the same year. And it's, we almost had that many at Minneapolis the first year we ever did it. Yeah, so there's something happening here in the lives. And what's great, let me tell you something. What's great about these conferences, and if you are not signed up for Seattle or you're not signed up for Minneapolis, okay, tell everyone you know, because this is going to fill up. And you're going to, so what happens in like some conferences is people go because they think, oh, the strength of this is going to be really good teaching. That's all true here. But what happens is that youth leaders and parents bring their kids with a sense of duty. Like this isn't just about, well, I want my kids to have a good experience in Christ. This is that I feel a certain duty to young people to make sure they know the truth in a way they can defend it, in a way that they can be kind of bulletproof in a lot of ways, or that's our effort anyway.
Well, you bring that to the table every time you come to our events.
Well, that sense of duty is a huge thing that drives people. When I remember I was at Minneapolis last time. I was in the parking lot. I was just getting ready to go in. I wasn't going to speak right away, so I was just going to go in and kind of hang out at the book table. And I was watching cars drive up in the parking lot and park and bring their kids in. And I thought to myself, This is an amazing work of God, because what's happening here is not just that kids want to come, and they do. It's that parents want them to go, and they are willing to bring them. They're willing to carve out their weekend to make sure their young people get to this conference. I think it's pretty powerful to watch from the park.
I'm with you on that. I'm getting shivers, you know, just as you're talking, and you convey this sense of urgency and duty and significance and weightiness when in your presentations, of course, and we always have you close because you close the event so strongly on Saturday afternoon. But it kind of reminds me of something that I remember you said a long time ago. You're offering autobiographically your experience with young people as you're teaching in youth groups, you know, in South Orange County, which is where your kids are kind of going up, and you want to be involved in the process, and you realize, and here's what you said to me, and you said, I got tired of throwing candy at kids.
Yeah.
And I made a commitment that in the youth group, that my goal now was to make sure that these kids that go through this, in 4 years, they don't leave Christ.
That's right.
Yeah, and so that you went from the fun, to, you know, like the candy at kids kind of thing, the pizza deal, and let's have fun and games, to discipleship, and that is, you've been on that, you've been hammering on that one ever since, and wonderfully in your work, your writing, your speaking, your involvement with Stand to Reason for many, many years now, and especially your consistent involvement with reality to that end. And it's magnificent.
Well, I can say that I've always thought of Stand to Reason as my home, and so we're not that far down the freeway from each other. So I just feel like it's an opportunity, and I know everybody on the staff there. I know your team. I feel like I'm kind of like a cousin to the team. So, and I love your team. But even the people don't realize that there's people behind the scenes right now who, like Kyle, who is running the show right now from behind the scene, right? And I mean, I cannot wait to see these guys when I get to go to the conferences, because they are just like, okay, like you're back with your family. Like you can exhale a little bit, you know, you can go, okay, we're doing this together. It's always the funnest thing I travel. You know, as I get older, I'm not inclined to travel as much as I used to. And I want to be home more with Susie, and I want to, you know, but these events, I get to go hang out with family. And it's just a lot easier. It's kind of, you know, you and I get to do this here. We also get to do it with Frank Turek at CIA. So there are times when we get to kind of hang out as a family and do this work together. Fun. And that's always more fun for me. So I'm just glad to be a part of it.
Well, see, you've been plugging, in a sense, Stand to Reason here in reality and all what we're really deeply involved in broadly here, and that is building up the body of Christ in a thoughtful way, and especially passing the baton to the next generation.
Yeah.
I want to talk about a particular way that you're doing that right now, and that's your latest book. Okay, so you have Cold Case Christianity, wonderful bestseller, banging away with me up there at the top of the charts today. Amazon.
By the way, you always remind me when I'm in second place. I just love that.
Well, you're ahead of me today, you know, and I don't check it every single day, you know, but I do on occasion check it out and see what's going on. And I'm glad to see you're up there, Jim.
Well, what I think is amazing is would you ever thought that we would be in a place, any of us really, that we would have an impact like this with books, which I always kind of wonder, is it a dying form? When I wrote this book, Person of Interest, my fear was, and I was really struggling with this, is content consumption shifting so much to video? But let me tell you what I learned here, Greg. This is an aside here for those of you who are interested in reading books. What's interesting in researching Person of Interest, when I'm really researching the impact that Jesus had on history, okay, that's a big part of what this book is.
Right.
And I'll tell you that it's interesting that I said this before, but I'll say it again. Books are important. And they'll always be important because they're physical. And so when you get a book, like I've got this book here someone sent to me, right? Let's say we print 100,000 of these things. They get shipped all over the world. They are physically located in 100,000 locations all over the world. When people watch our videos, they do not download a copy to their hard drive. And it wouldn't matter anyway because the technology will change 2 years from now. I used to have a Palm Pilot that was full of all kinds of data. I can't even get that data off the Pine Palm Pilot anymore because the formats have all changed.
Yeah.
So in the end, what happens with books is that if you've written about Jesus at some point in history, that is now geographically locatable. Mm-hmm. And you have to destroy all of those locations to get rid of the Jesus message, rather than just destroy one server or one website or whatever it may be where we're hosting all these
That's
things.
That's a great point. This is a great point. In fact, Amy and I were talking about an SDRS this morning, folks who listen to that, and I hope they do because it's magnificent, and it's not because of me. It's because Amy adds so much to it.
It's because of both of you.
She's like 150% of this thing. And anyway, she was making the point about people. Somebody asked a question about, is it okay if I just read my Bible on my iPhone? And we both weighed in on this, but this was a point that was being made. When you have a book, it is a physical thing in front of you. Oh, the iPhone's a physical thing too. It's an iPhone. It's not a Bible. When you have a Bible, this is your Bible. You can open it up and see two pages at once, lots of copy. You can make notes in it. All of it is very different to have that physical thing there. And thankfully, because we have the physical thing and so many of them all over the world, it guards in a very, very real sense the original information.
And
this is a huge with a Person of Interest.
Yes. And every time, by the way, you take notes on a separate pad of paper, right? You have your separate pad of paper and you take these notes and you keep a journal. And there are, like, for example, all of the science fathers who were Christ followers, which were the vast majority, they wrote personal journals about their devotion to Jesus, repeating verses, reciting verses, telling the story to themselves, writing about the story of Jesus, writing letters to others about Jesus. All of that stuff is now physical, that is located in a place that if you destroyed every New Testament, you'd still have the personal journals and notes of the science fathers. Mm-hmm. You'd be stuck with the person of Jesus and all of the recoverable data about Jesus in more detail from the science fathers than you can get from the church fathers. That's the crazy thing about it. The most robust recreation a reconstruction of the Jesus story in my research is from the science fathers. Those people who most people think, well, no, you can't do good science and hold to the miraculous, can you? You can't believe in a resurrection and still be a quantum, do any work in quantum mechanics. Really, well, the father of quantum mechanics happened to be a Jesus follower. So it turns out that you can do this work and hold these two truths at the same time.
And
you can reconstruct the story.
And it wasn't like two separate realms, you know, the science tells you how the heavens go and then religion tells you how to go to heaven. No, that wasn't their view. They were well integrated in appropriate ways. So now you've jumped vigorously into the content, and I hope that stimulates people's thinking about, well, what's coming next. So let's just back off from the specific you just mentioned to the bigger picture, because what you just said is really critical, and it has to do with the nature of the impact that Jesus of Nazareth has had on the world. And so, this is Person of Interest. Frankly, I was thinking, all right, you got Cold Case, you got God's Crime Scene, you got Forensic. What else you got to say here? You know, the Cold Case detective has played himself out, but you didn't, because you have this new book, a person of interest, which is a kind of term of art in your field. Why don't you explain a little bit about that and how that fits into the overall approach you're taking dealing with Jesus of Nazareth as a cold case detective?
So that term person of interest really kind of came into parlance really based on kind of federal investigations related to terrorism in the last couple of decades. But so in my early career, we would never use that expression. Now, what it typically though is used is to designate is somebody who is usually a potential suspect, but there's not enough evidence yet to file a case. So we're kind of working on this guy. We feel like we're close, but the DA won't take a case right now the way it is. We're going to have to do a little more work. Or it's a case that's so broad, we don't really have a suspect in view yet, but we do know that there's somebody out there that someone's described for us who has information that might lead us to a suspect. So that becomes our person of interest, the first domino of witnesses in a line of dominoes. Well, for me, I use the term with Jesus because this is how I first got engaged in the person of Jesus, is the first pastor I ever listened to. And it was just, I just dumbed into it, right? You know, my wife wanted to go to church. I thought, well, I avoided it for about 3 years in this neighborhood we were living in here. And I thought, I was living in this house. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to have to go. But eventually I did go. And a friend of mine had been inviting us. And I walk into this huge mega church. Pastor looks very ordinary, speaks very ordinary way, but describes Jesus amongst a lot of other things he said. He said that Jesus was the smartest person who ever lived. Was, you know, like this huge influence on, really? So that's what prompted me to buy a Bible, is that Jesus is, I could mine out the wisdom statements of Jesus. I didn't even care if Jesus was fictional, because you can learn a lot from fictional characters, right?
Sure.
I mean, Sherlock Holmes has some pretty interesting things to say.
Sure.
But it doesn't mean I have to believe in Sherlock Holmes actually lived in order to mine that truth. So I bought the Bible, and it's sitting right back here on my shelf, and it's a small pew Bible. It cost me $6 or $7. And I started to look at the red letters. And that's what started this whole thing for me. The claim was that Jesus was interesting. So I needed to know. Well, it turns out he's more than interesting, right? But what I try to make a parallel here. If you're not willing to open your Bible and you don't trust it as anything more than fiction, you could still learn. If you just ignored all of your Bibles, if every New Testament was destroyed, you would still know what we know today about Jesus. You can make a case for his historicity and deity if every New Testament was destroyed. And you can do that the same way we make a case for a nobody murder, right? We have nobody. He says she ran off. Actually, he killed her. And we can never find the body. 20 years go by.
And this, by the way, is a real case. This particular thing you're referring to is not just a metaphor, so to speak, in your practice as a cold case detective, but you walk through an actual... I'm familiar with this case, you know, because we've talked about it many times over the years. It's so interesting, and now you worked it into a book.
Yeah,
so
I've had two or three of these, Greg, where I was telling somebody earlier that this one case I had, 30 years went by, and he got rid of her body, and no one worked it as a murder for the first six. It was just a missing persons case. And for 30 years, he had convinced her family that she just ran off. So convincingly, as a matter of fact, that in the 30 years before I reopened the case, that family never called our agency one time to ask if we were working the case. Never once. Because they were convinced that she had just run off.
So if memory serves me correctly, so by the way, this is a crime with no body.
Right.
All right. So you got no body. All right. And this is kind of a where the motif fits in a parallel to the resurrection, because no body there either.
Right.
I mean, that's the point. So you got no body. I made a joke the other day with Amy. When I'm looking at the bad statistics reflecting what Christians believe, it's unbelievable. People identify. And I said, oh, my goodness, Jesus is probably rolling over in his grave right now. Bad joke. All right. But the fact is, there is no Jesus in the grave.
That's
part of the deal. You got no body. So what you have to do is construct with circumstantial evidence what you think took place, which is what you did in this particular case. And was this the very last case that you had that came to trial and you won with this one?
No, it wasn't. No, I had another case that came maybe two more after this that were on
A-line. Okay. I get my things mixed up. So tell us about, you have a motif here. You talk about a fuse and an explosion and fallout. And that fits into the crime assessment, and especially when there's no body. because the explosion is the thing that's in question. If you know, that's the murder, but there's no body. So you're looking at the fuse and the fallout to infer the explosion. Tell about how that works very briefly with the crime, and then we're going to shift it over to how you applied that to Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a DA who was very famous, who I worked with for years. He's a great friend. And he was always arguing this as far as a timeline in front of a jury. And I realized, but something explosive happened. If she vanished on that day, some explosion of anger. If it's a murder, something explosive happened. That means there's a fuse we ought to expect to burn up to that detonation. After the bomb explodes, there should be fallout all over the blast radius.
So it doesn't happen in a vacuum. Look at pieces leading up
That's
to it.
Right.
Okay, and then
the fuse and the fallout will point to what happened in the explosion. Same thing as true for Jesus. If you had nothing in the blast, if you said, I'm not going to look at any New Testament. I don't want to know anything that's recorded in that first century about, I'm going to look at only the fuse of history leading up to the first century and the fallout of history that you can state begins at 33 AD or BC or BCE rather, or CE, I should say. Whatever you want to call it. We know
common
one thing
era.
For sure. Everything changed. And the common era was inaugurated in the, we call it the first century for some reason. The question is, what is it that detonates, that explodes time? And so we call this the first century.
So Jim,
that's
let
what
me
we're
jump
in at in the book.
Yeah. And let me jump in here, because part of the reason I think this book is so well positioned in the current dialogue is you cannot go on the internet to find things about Jesus from the general population without running into all of these Jesus mythicist kinds of things, okay?
Yeah.
Never mind the scholars aren't on board with that, given the primary source historical material, the New Testament, which you're saying, we're not even going to talk about that. Okay, this has ramifications to that question with the New Testament out of the picture. So tell us.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of us, you know, we get this all the time, that there's somehow Jesus is a recreation of prior mythology. One thing we know for sure, all people of all generations, including the present generation, the vast majority of people on planet Earth believe in a higher power. And they have imagined this higher power with certain expectations, even today. If you are someplace in the world where you think there's a higher power responsible for creation, well, if I was to mine out your expectations, what you think this higher power would be, you're going to come up with very similar attributes. By the way, these attributes are also present in ancient mythologies. They're also, and there's a number of these. And so I actually read through all the ancient mythologies, and I extracted what I think are like 15. I could have done 12, I could have done 18, but I settled on 15. No myth has more than 10 of these, and no myth has less than maybe 6. But between 6 and 10 of these attributes, for example, a lot of people will say, well, yeah, you know, the myth comes in, the God comes into the universe in some supernatural way, appears on planet Earth in some unnatural, well, duh. That's not an unusual expectation. Now, by the way, they're very different. Could emerge out of the side of a mountain. Could come out of the thigh of another god. Could all kinds of weird ways these gods appear. And but so does Jesus. He appears in an unnatural way. So is this borrowed? No, what if I told you that after all of these ancient myths appear in history and the timeline, that fuse that burns up to the first century, if then when Jesus appears, he is the only historical person who possesses all 15 of the expectations of deity that the ancients imagined. Now, if you really think, really what you have are authors in the first century who are cobbling together for a Jewish audience,
right,
a series of characteristics that are entirely pagan, well, good luck with that. But my point is, would it be possible that God would eventually end up meeting, we're designed in God's image, we have thoughts about God that are pretty much universal, and then he shows up in the most robust and complete way, matching all of our expectations in the person of, this is why Paul says, you Athenians, you're very religious. I see a lot of temples here. I'm here to show you who the real God is, though. And that's what he does, is he reveals Jesus, who meets all of your expectations in a more robust way than you ever imagined. And this is why I think that every similarity to Jesus from an ancient mythology is actually an evidence for Jesus and not against him. By the way, these similarities are not that similar. They are very, very different. But the broad expectations are the same. I'll give you that. And that's what I would expect. By the way, when the expected meets the expectations of the expector, you get a better response. And that's what's happening with Jesus. He meets the expectations of pagans as well as all of the types of the Jews. How is that possible? He's foreshadowed by the types of Moses and Jonah and David and Joshua and
Joseph.
But he also meets the expectations of the pagans.
Right.
Because designed in God's image, we all have expectations, and God actually meets those expectations.
So in this case, in a certain sense, this is part of the fuse, okay?
Yes.
There are things that are going on before the time of Jesus that both in pagan religion and in Jewish religion that set up a certain kind of expectation or a profile of expectations, which Jesus, though not fulfilling, not satisfying those expectations in the same way in the details of these ancient mythologies, and that's the mistake the mythicists make.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we've seen this before. No, you haven't.
No.
You know, you don't have a, it's all different, you know, but it does fit these categories like a supernatural entry into the world, for example, et cetera, et cetera. And you go into all the detail there. But also at the same time, not only the pagans, but the Jewish expectation that we see in all these passages, it converges.
Yeah.
And this sets up a, if I'm just kind of reiterating your point, this sets up a kind of unique circumstance for this explosion, the visitation of God to the planet, fulfilling all those expectations. I'm with you so far, right?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, think about this. It sets up a unique window of opportunity that I call in crimes a red zone, a window in which the suspect's unique circumstances and the victim's unique traits open up a small window of opportunity for a crime to occur. And if it occurs there, you have a good sense that that is your suspect and that is your victim. Now, here, if God wanted to appear at a time when the most worshiping non-Christians were worshiping actively the deity that meets the expectations fulfilled in Jesus, it turns out there's like a 400 or 500 year window, because some of these mythologies, the worship of these mythologies stops. So if you wanted to arrive when people are still worshiping that God that's somewhat similar in their expectations to Jesus, you got to show up in a window. Well, he does. Now, that window gets smaller when you take a look at the culture fuse that is burning, even smaller when you look at the prophecy fuse, until finally you have a window of about 100 years. It just so happens that in that window, a new century begins, a new common era begins, and Jesus happens to be born right in the middle of that 100-year window.
Launching that. So now this brings me to another point that also has to do with the fuse. And I've heard your talk a number of times. I heard it at CAA, which just blew me away. I heard it 3 weeks ago at Reality. You're going to be doing it again this week. I'm going to sit through every one of them, all six realities, because I love this talk. It's so powerful because how everything fits together so nicely, the way you characterize it, and things I honestly never, ever countenanced before. But one of the things you do, and you've just given us a piece of the fuse, you know, the expectation from pagans and from Jews, but there's also something that has to do with the time. Some people say, why didn't Jesus come now? You got the internet, you got TV, you got, you know, all kinds of stuff, and this would be the time to get your message out. But you argue, no. There was a reason why he came then and not now. It was, as Paul put it, the fullness of time. Explain that detail of the fuse, because it's fascinating.
Yeah, so we'll deal with the second question last, but the first question about, well, why did not come now? But if you look at the fuse that burns up, the Roman Empire does put certain things in place: common alphabet, common language, leveraging a common technology of papyrus, a 200-year period of peace called the Pax Romana, in which we can shift resources from war to infrastructure. I can build roads.
Right.
The
like
very
the
roads that Paul
right.
walks as he proclaims the message of Jesus were not available to him 300 years earlier, because those roads were not being constructed. They were being constructed by a peacetime Roman Empire that wanted all roads to lead to Rome. Mm-hmm. So in the end, the infrastructure was in place. Even a postal service was in place in time
Amazing.
For the Jesus message to catch on like wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
in addition, I actually chart all of the prophecies, not by type. Sometimes you'll see books that will say, okay, here's all the prophecies about his crucifixion. Here's all the prophecies about the Messiah's birth. No. I want to know, when do they occur in the timeline? Because it turns out, though, part of the reason why Jesus shows up when he does is because the first five investigative questions always lead you to the sixth. The what, when, why, how, where always lead you to the who in a criminal investigation. But if you chart the prophecies, starting with the earliest ones in Genesis all the way through, you don't get the what, why, when, how, where until you get really to Mount Malachi. And now it's so firm that if Jesus shows up, you could actually use prophecy to demonstrate his deity, which is what everyone in the book of Acts is going to do. Mm-hmm. Well, you couldn't have done that before Isaiah. You can't use prophecy to make your case. There's not enough prophecy out there to make case. It's too broad. You need certain prophecies to be in place so you can do what everyone in the New Testament does. Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the reasons why Jesus comes when he does. And Daniel puts in a very tight window. From the reconstruction of Jerusalem to the rebuilding of Jerusalem to the fall of the temple, about 4th
century Daniel's
BC,
prophecy, right?
Yeah, to 70 AD. That's when the Messiah is going to come. That takes that 500-year window from the spiritual red zone and knocks it down to about 100 years. And that's where he shows up. Now, why doesn't he come today? There's a sense in which the technology would be an advantage to anyone coming to claim deity in 2021. Do you really think that's true? Honestly, when's the last time you watched anything on multimedia that you actually believed was true? I mean, we used to actually build little miniature sets to do monster movies. Now the computer graphics are so good, you're like, well, I'm not quite sure what's real. I have seen green screen sets where people are walking through, they show the green screen, then they put in the CG behind it, and you're like, oh my gosh, what a set they had to build. No, that was all CG, all computer graphics. We're using computer graphics to do small things. In the preseason, Tom Brady was throwing a football on video on his Twitter feed into a football feeder, which tossed right back to him. He never missed it. He hit the apex from 15 yards away every time. Well, the next day he told us it was a fake. It was all CG. Honestly, there are people right now who are claiming to raise people from the dead on social media, and you don't believe them either. There's so much noise and so much tomfoolery and so much computer graphics that I'm not sure that today would be a better day to do this. Yep. It turns out that all of that distraction and noise, and it was not available in the first century. When things happened in front of people, they're going, wow, it happened in front of me. Eyewitness testimony was what had spread the message of Jesus. And I actually think that eyewitness testimony is far better than social media.
Well, that's a great point. And it's true. You watch the movies now, you think, man, how do they do that? It's unbelievable how they did it. And this is how these little bitty women can beat up all these big guys, you know, on TV. All the women are the heroes.
Don't get me started on cop shows, okay? Do not get me started on cop shows.
Okay, all right. I'm probably we're in the same court on that one. But, okay, let's look. Now we want to shift. We want to shift to the fuse to the fallout. And to me, this is the most fascinating part, because this is where you really make the case that you can reconstruct everything about the life of Jesus from all the impact that Jesus had in Western civilization at multiple levels. Yeah. And you have a chapter about each one of these things. So I just want to, you can lead off with whichever thing that you think is most important, but let's just walk you some of these kind of cultural layers that we are all participating in. You mentioned the science one. Maybe you want to just close that one out since you already mentioned it, because it's a powerful one.
So much is hard about this, right? Because I do a visual case in front of a jury, and so it's all visual. And so the book has got 400 illustrations. Because I just think if you could see it, you go, oh, I get it, right? Yeah. And that's why it's hard to communicate in words what I did in the book. I think the book is really like part graphic novel. But my point, by the way, when I did the audio version of this book, it takes me about 3 days to read one of my books for an audio version. This took two days because it's that fast of a read.
So many pictures,
400 illustrations. Yeah. But what I noticed in the science is I'm looking. Remember, there are good books that have been written. I've got them that are just about the impact that Jesus has had in various areas. Okay, that's good. I'm not looking for just that. I want deep impact, but I'm also looking for, can I reconstruct the story of Jesus from that category?
Right. Right.
And it turns out you can, in weird, surprising, I'll give you a couple. In the sciences, as we said, if you look at the growth curve of science over history, and I've charted it, I simply said, give me all the top scientists in the first century BC. Well, that was called natural philosophy. Okay, there are some.
Right.
Give me the first ones in the first century AD, second century, third. I charted them. The list was ridiculous. I had a research assistant. If not for COVID, I don't know how we would have done this book. It just took forever, okay? And so we charted this path, and then I said,
silver lining on that cloud then.
Yeah, there was. And so I asked, where does Jesus fall in this curve of science? He could fall anywhere. He could fall, halfway through the curve. No, he falls right before the curve takes off. Is that a coincidence or is that a catalyst? I needed to know. So I started to look at who are these scientists And what you will see is that with every significant development of Christian history, there's a bump in scientific activity. When monasteries come into place, in cathedral schools, bumps. When universities, first three are founded by Christians, at Bologna, Paris, and Oxford, a bump. Printing press, a bump. Reformation, scientific revolution. You see these bumps. They could be coincidental. But what's interesting is the people who dominate sciences are all Christ followers. I'm not talking about, well, up till Darwin and then after Darwin. No, no, no. Through Darwin and in the century following Darwin, they are still Christians, Christ followers. As a matter of fact, as you do the research, I started to notice that these expressions were being used in the research. He's the father of modern astronomy. He's the father of modern chemistry. Father of, father of, father. I thought, well, right. Go back. I said, I want you to go back, my research assistants. And I want you to find every place you found the expression father of with one of these scientists. Now, first of all, their Christian identity has largely been scrubbed from the internet. But I wanted to use the internet also so that anyone in this generation who's not reading encyclopedias or buying books can just Google it. And you will. So I know that I'm only getting the tip of the iceberg because most right. of these Christian identities have been scrubbed. But then I started looking for father of. Then I realized, oh, a lot of these people are award winners. Go back. 950 scientists. Go back and tell me if they're award winners in some way, Nobel, some scientific award. Well, you will not believe what we discovered. I have a list of all of the science disciplines that were founded and initiated or fathered. These called the science fathers, I call these.
And you display this graphically in your lectures,
it's
reality, for example. I know, yeah. It's just amazing.
It's ridiculous.
I'm looking at it.
Teaching our kids this. We need to be teaching our kids this. We have owned the sciences. By the way, Muslims were a huge factor in the sciences from the establishment of Islam till about the 12th century. And then they drop off the map for largely theological reasons. We have to make a decision. Are we going to explore the natural realm as part of our further exploration of God and his nature? Or are we going to say, no, all we need to know is inside scripture. We're going to leave that alone because we either politically don't trust scientists anymore. Or we don't trust the, we have to make a decision. We have owned this discipline, and now we're going to abandon it? That happened once before in Islam. We should not take that approach. It turns out natural revelation has always been, like Kepler says, I'm thinking God's thoughts after him.
Right.
That's an important way to view the scientific exploration. Well, anyway, the point is, if you simply had their journals, if you simply had with these people all the way into the 21st century, what they have said about Jesus in their personal notes, some have written books, you could reconstruct the story of Jesus from the personal notes of science fathers over the generation. Not only that, the schools where science is being done, universities. If you just Google the universities, modern universities, now, ancients had ways of educating themselves. But the modern university, as you and I are thinking about it, a geographic location where a body of students comes together, there's a faculty of resident scholars who teach something, and then they award a diploma at the end of a certain course of curriculum, that is a uniquely Christian invention at Bologna, Paris, and Oxford. And those 24 schools that emerge from those three founding schools are the vast majority of the science fathers in the scientific revolution come from those 24 universities. It turns out that if you were to visit the top 15 schools in the year by any measurement, they are all founded by Christians, even though probably most of them don't even acknowledge Jesus anymore. But they started off as Christian institutions. And here's what's great about it. If you simply visited the campuses, you'll see the original buildings where a lot of the instruction took place were often chapels and places where the images of Jesus are still there on the walls, in the windows, in the verses printed on the buildings, in the charters of the founding members of that university. If all you had were the charters and the buildings, you could reconstruct the story of Jesus. I'll give you the list of what you can reconstruct from the top 15 universities in the world. So it turns out, unless you're willing to destroy those physical university buildings, you cannot erase the story of Jesus. Mm-hmm. He can be reconstructed.
Well, this goes back to our earlier conversation about having physical tokens, representations of
things.
That's right. If you got digital stuff goes away. In fact, it goes away instantly after you're finished referring to it.
Yeah.
When you're looking at it, then you change pages. You go to TikTok or, you know, whatever.
Right.
But when you have a physical thing, there it is sitting there for ages and ages and ages. Hopefully our books will be like that as time goes on, God willing.
Right.
That's how we got caught talking about this particular topic. But it's a great point, is these physical things stay. And I mean, I just, in my limited exposure, I know going around places in Europe, go to Washington, D.C., you see the same kind of thing. The record of the impact of Christianity is etched in the stone.
That's right.
Everywhere. And it can't be, you can't go to the charters. I had never even thought about that. But the charters are the reasons why a particular organization, university, started. Here it is. Here's our, what we're all
our
about.
Mission statement.
Yeah, their mission statement, so to speak. Okay, so now we've covered, with regards to the fallout, we've looked at science, incredible, because it's not just the fathers of science who didn't find their belief in Christ to be a science stopper, but rather a science starter. But it's also the substance of their own reflections in their private writings that recapture all of these details of the life of Christ in Scripture and stuff like that, okay? And then we talked about the impact in education. There's a whole nother area where you can do your whole reconstruction just focusing in on that. There is more, there are more things like this that I thought one of the most fascinating aspects when you do this in your talk has to do with music. And this is where it blew my mind to hear what you had to say. So to walk us through that, we got about 10 minutes more. We got about 20 minutes more. To walk us through some of the detail there, because music means so much to so many people, especially to young people, and especially what for me are kind of strange forms of music. You're a little younger than I am, not that much, but enough to be more in touch. And plus, you make it your business to be more in touch. I'm out of touch, and that's okay with me. The young guns can handle all this, but I was really fascinated as you started to quantify the impact of Jesus of Nazareth in the music of the Western world.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about this, and here's what I always say. People always say, well, Jim, all of this discussion you're talking about is Western world stuff. It's just Western civilization, Western culture, Western, 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 Western. And of course, you know, a lot of us now are pushing back against Western culture. It's colonial, it's all of these things. But the reality of it is that no matter what we do, we're on a platform right now. Well, we're going to be podcasting this when we're done. We're on a platform where we're using YouTube and other international platforms. It's that we are exporting ideas and ways of life that now are, so you can say, even if you're not colonizing them physically, you are colonizing them from a content perspective, because so many of these major platforms are now available internationally. So for example, if there's a certain style of music, well, guess what? K-pop is Korean pop music. If you're listening to K-pop, it's like, to me, it kind of feels like boy bands from like the 80s and 90s. So my point is that we are exporting. If you've ever watched any of the K-roms, Korean romance comedies, romantic stories, there was one on Netflix. It was one of the biggest shows on Netflix, Crash Landing on You. I watched every episode of that silly thing, okay? And it was, each episode's like 90 minutes long. I watched them all. But it feels like they're just slightly a generation behind us. But we are exporting. You can't help but export. And it turns out Jesus, regardless of where he initiates, he initiated in a small corner of the Roman Empire.
Right.
And from that small corner, he exported his persona, his worldview, and his influence globally. This is not just a phenomenon of the West.
Right.
It is now a global phenomenon. Whatever kind of music you're listening to, whatever genre you're listening to, remember that this is something unique about the Judeo-Christian worldview. It is a musical worldview. Mm-hmm. David wrote Psalms. Those Psalms were transmitted orally. The written words were transmitted by Scripture, but the melodies were transmitted orally until a Christ follower invented musical notation. Mm. If you're using musical notation today, you can thank a Christian for that. Mm. If you're singing more than just a cappella, if you've incorporated instruments, well, those innovators were Christian innovators. If you're doing harmonies rather than just a simple melody, but you're including harmonies along major and minor scales, you can thank Christians for innovating that. Well, why? Well, think about it today. What is the one location every week where someone's going to get up on a stage and sing to an audience. The church does that.
Church.
We are a musical worldview, and we have demonstrated this from the beginning. Jesus sung a hymn, probably one of David's Psalms, at the end of the Last Supper. Then Paul tells us we should continue to do this. You can reconstruct the story of Jesus, every significant detail of his ministry, from just the hymns sung by the church in the first three centuries. I collected all those hymns. I have them in my case notes, which is available online as a PDF file. By the way, this has got so many illustrations that there's about 250 pages. There's a 50-page case file in the book and a 279-page case file PDF that's waiting online for you, because I wanted you to see what hymns am I talking about and what is the data I'm extracting from these hymns. I'll give you all of that in the case notes.
Let me jump in here for a moment, because this point is really important, because, Jim's a detective, so that means details matter. All the particulars matter, and they add up over time to point in a certain direction. When you go online, when the average person goes online, Jim, they're going to see claims made by skeptics. They are not going to see case files. They are not going to see a logical flow of information. They're not going to see, usually, something like a carefully done argument with the facts there justified from primary source documentation. What's going to happen, and in many cases, is you're going to see the same story told over and over and over again, cycling and cycling and cycling through the internet. And this is why I'm really glad that it's your instinct to do this. You've been doing it for years, solving crimes, that you have gone precisely through all the details to get all the information on the table so it's all represented accurately and you can draw an accurate, balanced conclusion from all the evidence available. And not only did you do that, but you make it all available if somebody wants to thread through that. And that's
part of this too. You know, look, when I do a case, let's say we do 10 weeks in front of a jury and we're doing 10 weeks of showing you the evidence and cross-exam, all that. Okay, fine, we're done now. Now I'm going to do a 3-hour, 4-hour closing argument. Well, books for me are the closing argument, right? In other words, I'm not an academic. I have all the data there for you. But my goal is not to be academic, because I'm trying to do a closing argument to persuade a jury. That is a 3-hour summary of the 10 weeks. I'll include the 10 weeks, but the book has to be a persuasive 3-hour visual summary of all of that stuff. Some people will want to dig through that stuff. Good. God bless you. Do it. Some people are like, you know what? Okay, I'm not really that interested. I just want to know what. Give me the summary. Give me the short order. What's the argument?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm willing to do that. And we are translators. That's what we do. I don't have a PhD. I have a DET. There's a difference, okay? Now, I will tell you that having a PhD does not necessarily lead you to a proper inference from evidence.
Right.
We bring in PhDs on both sides. And one PhD will tell you the other PhD is crazy. This guy will say, no, he's wrong. I'm right. Same qualifications. Looking at the same evidence, two different inferences. We tell juries, use your common sense. You don't have to agree with either one of these PhDs. Mm-hmm. They're not getting a vote. You're the only ones who get a vote. And we made sure we didn't put any PhDs on the panel. So the point here is that I think we've got enough to infer properly from evidence.
Right, I agree. And I cut you off in the middle of your accounting of the flow of development of music influenced by not just Christianity, influenced by Christ is the point. He's the explosion and the resurrection. That's the explosion.
You can go back and look at all of the top artists in the last 100 years. I looked at the IMDb, Billboard, Rolling Stone. It's about 150 artists because they overlap in certain areas and some of them. And they're all different genres, hip-hop to country, you name it, it's there. Motown, gospel, it's all there. And it turns out I went through the personal catalogs of every one of those artists. All but two have sung about Jesus of Nazareth. Now, I want you to think about that for a second. What other historical figure in the history of historical figures has been such an inspirational irritation that somebody has decided to sing about him? You will not find anyone else in the history of persons who has been sung about more, painted, etched, sculpted, drawn more, written about as a topic of a book more. Christ figured, in other words, his figure is so strong that even those who write fiction reimagine their fictional characters as some rough sketch of the Jesus figure. Nobody has had this impact. Now ask yourself, why would this nobody? He is truly, if you look at the history of people, You'd have to qualify him as a nobody, born nowhere, raised nowhere, had no family, had no money, no social media platform, never wrote a book, never wrote a concert, never led a nation, never ruled a nation, never led an army, never had any of the stuff that you would think would matter. Look at all the people in the first century. Together, they've had no impact on history. Yet this guy, who was hated and despised, but hunted down by the people who were powerful and rejected by religious people and betrayed by the people who said they loved him, then falsely accused and brutally beaten, and they had to borrow a grave to stick him in the ground. This is the guy who's sung about more, written about more, illustrated more, affected education more, science more, and by the way, every other religious worldview mentions him. And this is the guy? How can that possibly be?
Oh, that's magnificent.
That's why we have to think about Jesus differently.
Right. You know, you just touched on something else that you talked about, and I think it's fabulous. It has to do with everybody wants Jesus on their team, but Jesus doesn't need anybody else on his team, kind of thing. That was my takeaway. So tell us about that, because you just touched on it. You hinted at that. This, to me, is really significant. All the things that you've said so far really add up to something unbelievably extraordinary and significant happened at that explosion. There's only one candidate for that, Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, this is why they call it BC and AD, you know, common era. That's to avoid the Christ language for some people who are sensitive to that. But because it was that individual that that was the rift that created the difference between ancient history and more modern history and everything, and then penetrated in all of these areas. But then when you look at this individual, so that just, to me, that just, it just hands down demonstrates that something real happened that that had this significant impact for a reason and without parallel, okay?
Yeah.
But this other point you're touching on, to me, is also really significant when you compare the way that other religions, and we have about 5 minutes here, try to co-opt Jesus for their project.
Yeah.
Yet Jesus' attitude was entirely different.
Well,
tell
and
us
it probably
that.
Shouldn't surprise us that every religion that follows Jesus, because of the kind of impact he made, would at least some point, you know, he's going to be in the Quran, he's in the writings of Baha'u'llah, he's in a lot of religions that have a beginning date following the first century, end up having to kind of deal with the person of Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. But what's fascinating to me is that all of the religious worldviews that preceded Jesus, that now still exist into the common era, right?
Like Hinduism.
Yeah, they end up accommodating Jesus also. So if you read the writings of the leaders in Hinduism and Buddhism, you will see that they will hat tip Jesus. They'll say, you know, Jesus is a wise teacher in the shape or form of our wise teachers. They'll even begin to give Jesus their titles. They'll say he's a man on the way to Buddhahood who's enlightened. They'll say that he fits within a New Age worldview. Even those religions that don't exist anymore ended up modifying their habits. Mithraic worshipers who worship Mithras modified the way they met. Attis worshipers, Heracles worshipers. Attis and Heracles take on different attributes in the common era than they had before the common era. And these attributes are like Jesus's attributes. Well, why is that happening? It turns out that everyone so respects the person of Jesus that they are willing to modify, mention, or merge Jesus into their worldview. Now, remember, some of these folks preceded Jesus by centuries. Yet Jesus, when he shows up, does not hat tip them. They hat tip him later, but he never hat tips them. Why is that? He says, you know, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Except through me, then no one gets to the Father.
Right.
He doesn't modify. He doesn't say, but you know, in Buddha, he agreed with me. He was like, none of that. He doesn't even hat tip the Jewish tradition. But through him, he's extremely explicit. But I always say it this way. I had a case one time where I had eight suspects. I kid you not. Eight suspects when I started that looked like they were all about equally good for this murder. And I had to work through these eight suspects. And eventually, one is going to stand out with unique features. He has a unique opportunity to kill her, a unique relationship with her, a unique anger level, some unique things that separate him from the other seven. When that guy starts to separate out with those unique features, you're probably on the right track. Jesus separates himself out with unique features. Number one, he won't hat tip anybody else. Number two, he says, you know, it's not what you're going to do that's going to get you here, dude. It's what I've done for you. He's alone in that statement. In those two ways, he is incredibly unique. All the others say very similar things and have similar paths to whatever the expectation is. If it's nirvana, if it's to be with the presence of God, whatever it may be. Yet Jesus comes at it completely counterintuitively. He's that unique suspect in a range of suspects that you ought to consider seriously, because when you see unique features from all the other guys, you're probably on the right track.
Well, this is what's really stood out for me when I wrote The Story of Reality and talked about Jesus in his life, is that he never drew attention to his teaching. It was always himself. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the bread of life. I am the living water. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. I, me, which would be unbelievably arrogant of everyone else on the planet, except for people didn't see it that way when Jesus said it, because he spoke with authority and he acted with authority.
That's right.
And then didn't use that authority or power to benefit himself. He surrendered himself to die. It's so thrilling to talk with you, Jim. I mean, I got a minute and a half here to go, but I get to see you in a couple of days, like 3 days, 2 days. I don't know. We'll see you in Seattle I keep wanting to say Rethink, but Reality. And then we're going to see you in Minneapolis for Reality in November, 4 weeks from this weekend. And 2,000 people already signed up for that. Yeah. I mean, we're just shy 20 people of 2,000. We'll be in Dallas in February together. We'll be in Philly, I think.
That's right.
Philly and Augusta. That will be April, March and April. I get the dates mixed up. But folks, you can go to realityapologetics.com and get all the details there. And it's not just Jim. We got a whole bunch of people there. But Jim he's a fixture as far as I'm concerned. And Jim, if you ever die, I'm going to kill you. Okay? Or at least you got
to
die.
Die
after me. But
I'll investigate it. If you do it, I'll investigate it. How's that?
Okay, that's right. Okay, what happened to Coke? All right, buddy. But you've made such a magnificent contribution to us at Stand to Reason, and we're glad to have had a role in your own life. And I deeply value our friendship and our relationship. And I'm on your team, buddy.
I feel the same way. But folks, trust me, if you have waiting to the last minute to sign up for Reality, don't wait. Every year there's somebody who says, oh, I couldn't get in. Do you have any extra tickets? No, I'm sorry, we don't. So I want you to sign up now. Don't wait.
Okay, dynamite. J. Warner Wallace, the book is Person of Interest, Why Jesus Still Matters in a World That Rejects the Bible. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends.